Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. When we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this September the 3rd on the West Coast, now September the 4th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those who may be listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, and before we get into bringing tonight's guest on board, I want to reference a piece that I mentioned at the beginning of last night's show. It's a story about how the farmers across the country began to be hoodwinked and foreclosed by the banks a number of years ago, particularly beginning in the middle of the 1970s. And these were unlawful foreclosures on farms, and not many farmers knew that they could fight this, although they received some help. And in the process of a case being brought to court, it was revealed that there was actually a demand made by certain members of the military to intercede and stop this unlawful takeover of the government by the banks and their agents, we'll say, because there were many people who had sued. There was actually a settlement that had been worked out for some 336,000 claims that were filed against the U.S. government, and the payout on that was to be $6.6 trillion. Again, $6.6 trillion with a T, dollars. The case was heard in a Michigan court. The media was kept out of the event, and so were the people that worked in the local courthouse for 4 days out of the week, from a Monday through a Thursday. They were kept out so no one would know what was going on. And it, back at that time, it had been determined, and I should say subsequently, working up to 1992. In 1992, there was a task force of some 300 retired and 35 active U.S. military officers who supported constitutional law, who made some demands, and basically what they found was that there was some $800 trillion sitting in accounts that should have been applied to the national debt long, long before that. Money was hidden in offshore banks, many European banks, and the gold of the country had been also shipped out. So I recommend that you try to get a hold of that online. It's written by James Rink, R-I-N-K, and it doesn't have a title to it, although it's pretty clear that he's describing the framework and the foundation of NASARA and what it is intended to do to stop the communist, fascist, Zionist overthrow of this country. And I have to tell you that I agree with everything that's in this piece. He was or he has pointed out that there are several stipulations that go along with NASARA. Actually, he names 19 of them, and they still apply. That the laws are still on the books. They've just hidden this from the public. There has been somewhat of a settlement under the condition that no one talks about it. But then on this show, we haven't made any settlement with anyone. So we're going to talk about that. And I'll be discussing this during a show next week, you can be assured. But you might want to read up on that, because I get a lot of questions from people asking if Nasara is real. In fact, this totally played into what happened on 9/11 to cover up Nasara and to cover up a lot of the corruption that was going on. With that, I invite back to Evident Footprints tonight our resident science advisor. He's a regular guest on Friday nights, has been since the inception of this radio show. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and his name is Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Don. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, have to say. all things.
I didn't catch the whole thing of what you're pushing, but I'd sure like to hear about it. Is it an article or a book? What is it?
No, it's an article written by James Rink, who was privy to the real estate shenanigans that were going on. And the corruption in the banking system as far back as the 1970s. And he basically wrote a piece that connects the dots between all of the people who were aware of Nasara and trying to hide it, trying to prevent the public from learning about it, although there were people who had invested money into what were called, or still being called today, the Prosperity and the Freedom Funds. And basically they just interceded and actually forced Bill Clinton to sign this agreement and this we could say an executive order of sorts that permitted this to happen. We would end up doing 2 hours on the show to talk about this tonight, but just wanted to, again, recommend that people look this up, that they can find it. And I may be posting this over the weekend. So to answer your question, it's an article, not a book.
Well, I'll be sure to read it, I can tell you that.
Yes. So how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm traveling, as I told you I would be, and there's a big time difference between where I am and where you are, but I was lucky that the cell phone picked up your signal. I didn't know if you'd be able to reach me or not.
Well, I was unsure also, but here you are. So can you hear me okay? Is the connection good?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay.
There's a little bit of an echo on this end, but I think that that's because of the room I'm in, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can always throw a towel over your head, and that'll dampen the sound a little bit. You don't have to do that, though, Jim.
I'm sure glad you added that.
we've been talking.
I look a little ridiculous with a towel over my head at this point.
Yeah, we've been talking over the past few weeks about energy and energy production and the various ways that the universe is wired, if you want to use that term. It's an invisible wiring system, but nonetheless, there's a grid. And information in all forms travels throughout the universe on that grid and seems to keep the basic fundamentals of nature in accordance with each other. And it's only upon man's interference, particularly here on the Earth that changes. And we've discussed at length the fact that we're being lied to about known technologies and things that would really benefit mankind, because there's this supposition that everything has to be metered and charged. Someone has to get rich off of the blood, sweat, and tears of the international slave kingdom, if you want to call it that. And we feel, you and I both agree, as many of our listeners do, that it's time that these games stop and that we get down to serious business and allow new technologies to be developed and unimpeded, and that they be made available if they bring beneficial results to the rest of the world. That we're not here just to pay somebody for something that belongs to everyone. And I know you had quite a bit more that you wanted to say about that. And we've gone off on some tangents, but rightfully so. We've covered a lot of what's going on. Still, the name of the game is the oil business, while they try to prepare themselves for wind power and just another way to convert electricity. But we're not even talking about something that's really practical. There are so many drawbacks to the wind turbines and all of that related technology, especially when they're spraying chemtrails all over the place. You want to comment on it, on any of that, or continue to proceed in your talk?
Well, the realm that we were headed for in that conversation, if I remember correctly, was, you know, what is the ultimate situation that we envision? And by the way, others have envisioned. People like Tesla and John Keeley, for instance, Hendershot, and many others, just to name a few, have always assumed that there is an infinite ocean of energy at our disposal. And everything is immersed in it. And so the real question is, how do you avail yourself of it? And the interesting thing is that it happens automatically if you know what to look for. And this is one of Tesla's, biggest secrets, because I'm not sure that it was really intended to be a secret, but it was certainly something that he discovered in his legitimate research and tried to share with people. But they weren't hearing it in those days. Perhaps because of technological reasons, you know, just not having the understanding. But it didn't take long for the moneymongers to make sure that the ignorance was perpetuated. And Steinmetz and others who modified a lot of the early writings and the mathematics that were associated with the work that Tesla was doing, essentially redesigned the physics of electrical engineering to ensure that certain very subtle characteristics were never broadly discovered by anybody. And this is one of the reasons why, first of all, none of this stuff is taught, and second of all, even the most progressive thinkers don't necessarily have the wherewithal to find these subtle little facts that add up to some very big conclusions. And of course, what we're talking about is tapping the vortex or tapping the ethereal pressure well, I think today they refer to it as the vacuum energy of space. It's all the same stuff. And the interesting thing is that, like so many other things, it's always been there. It's just a question of what we were mentioning last week. The consciousness has to expand to the point where suddenly you notice it, and you know what it means, and how to do something with it. But the people that are in charge have made absolutely stern efforts to defocus, or maybe a better term would be refocus, the attention of people in such a way that not only do they not bother to look for these subtle characteristics of physics, but they're actually scolded for attempting to go there, because everything is now hinging on the so-called laws of energy conservation. And there's such an enormous stigma against anything which appears to be a violation of these laws, and it's all completely out of proportion. I mean, people can lose their jobs, they can be villainized, they can have all sorts of complications simply by insinuating anything that implies that if they're moving in a direction other than what the establishment says is in reality. And to me, that's the ultimate expression of arrogance, because who are we to limit what the universe is capable of? And especially doing it with a lie, you know. But anyway, where we were headed, I believe, was to investigate the possibility of tapping into an infinite source of energy, which would allow a totally different paradigm to subsist on Earth and result in the sudden release of a whole series of suppressed technologies and the knowledge necessary to support that stuff. And the first step, in my opinion, to getting to that plateau of accomplishment is to answer the question of, well, where is this nebulous energy hiding? And I think that that's where we were at or approaching at the end of the last show.
Yes. If I may interject something, you mentioned Charles Steinmetz. He had patented a number of innovations in the areas of system distribution in alternating current, and he began his work in New York about the time that Tesla did, maybe a year or so later, as far as I know. His coming to the United States almost didn't happen because of his being a dwarf and being deemed to be unfit or unhealthy when he arrived at Ellis Island. But nonetheless, he worked with General Electric in Schenectady, New York. And one of the things that always impressed me, he said, "No man really becomes a fool until he stops asking questions." And I think that's important. So I should ask you a question. So I eliminate myself from that possibility. How come we don't hear so much about his work in the mainstream? Do you think it's His demise was sort of mirrored in the life of Nikola Tesla, in terms of whether or not the authorities wanted that information to get out to the general public. It's one thing to look up patents, but if you're not aware that they exist, I mean, where do you start looking?
Well, I don't honestly know anything about his demise, but I do know a great deal about his work. He's written several really worthwhile books, if you're into the physics of alternating current. But we mustn't forget one thing. The General Electric Corporation that hired him was an amalgamation of several different companies that were involving such characters as Thomas Edison and J.P. Morgan. And they were essentially competitors to the Westinghouse Corporation. And one of the reasons why Steinmetz was brought on board was because he was a fantastic mathematician. And some of the work that Tesla was doing was scrutinized very carefully by Steinmetz with the intention of rearranging some of the equations and basic information in such a way that it would limit the possibility of people finding, shall we call it, the stepping off point that Tesla had found, which led him to an understanding of these higher octaves of power expression. And I don't know if he's, you might say, coerced in doing it, or if he felt that the world wasn't ready for what Tesla was advocating. I'm not sure what his motivation was, but apparently a lot of the stuff that he worked on was done in such a way as to steer the engineering community away from certain conclusions. And I can tell you what they are, because I spent years tracking down the very point of departure that Tesla himself managed to discover, which allowed him to go to these other realms of consciousness in the electrical engineering field. And a lot of it, without being specific, I mean, it's just too difficult to do on the phone for one thing. And for another thing, you know, if I get too specific, I threaten my own patents. But basically what we can say is that any circuit that is activated by a forcing function, which is sinusoidal in nature, and which, when the circuit contains more than one passive element, for instance, a resistor and a capacitor, or a resistor and an inductor, or perhaps even three, a resistor, a capacitor, and an inductor, those arrangements require some pretty stiff differential equations to explain the phenomenon that occur when circuits are activated by the proper type of forcing function. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this, but basically, there are two branches of these equations. One is called the steady state phenomenon, or the steady state solution, and the other is referred to as the transient solution. Now, there's not much of a transient involved when you turn on a light bulb, for instance, but there's an enormous transient involved when you activate 50 miles of transmission line, for instance. And so, you know, the particular parameters which are involved in these things are very important to consider, because they highlight or call attention to certain of these characteristics in the transient state that you wouldn't normally notice, for instance, on a laboratory bench, unless you were already convinced that you should be looking for something. But the point I'm leading up to is that in the steady state solution of most of the applications of everyday electrical engineering to the transmission of power, you don't see anything magical going on. It's pretty well understood. It's pretty straightforward. And it's almost always linear in its response. Or if it's not linear, it's very predictable what the curve is. The other part of the solution, however, the transient solution, is another story altogether. And it's a very complex situation, but the point that's so interesting about it is that in the transient solution of these things, there appears a component which is not supplied by the forcing function. And yet, without that component, you wouldn't be able to have the steady-state solution which follows. And so it turns out that that particular component is, in fact, a contribution from the ether. And when you understand what it's doing and where it comes from, then you start to see where Tesla is headed with his technology and why we're actually barking up the wrong tree in what we're doing. Now, I'm convinced that there are some people in places of authority or places of knowledge who are well aware of this, and they are the guardians, you might say, of this information so that it doesn't get into the wrong hands. But the point is that the technology for producing very inexpensive sources of power have been around and have been understood for at least 150 years. And still nobody, or at least very few people, have done anything worthwhile with the information. And I think that the control that's being exerted on this comes from two primary sources. One is ignorance, or education, depending on which side of the coin you want to look at. And the other is the availability of money for research. And we both know that both those facets are well controlled by the powers that be. And so it's a tough call. And the other thing, of course, is that if you do stumble across this type of stuff and try to do something with it, everybody just says, oh, well, he's an eccentric, he's a muck. There's nothing there, everybody knows that. If there is anything to it, it would have been done a long time ago. That's one of the favorite arguments that you hear. But unfortunately, it's part of the big lie.
What do you... Where do you see that going now? I mean, this has been going on for quite some time. This is more than 100 years that this has been the reality of the way we use electricity around the world has been controlled, and all of the inventions that have been developed to liberate us from that have been quashed. Do you see it? I guess, you know, it's a coin toss in a way, but you yourself, do you get the impression that something is changing, something is shifting in that regard?
Well, when I was a little bit younger and I had more time on my hands, I spent a great deal of my personal life running around the country and even other countries trying to meet people. It sounded like they were investigating these types of things. And I uncovered an awful lot of people who were just plain nuts. I uncovered a lot of people that had partial truths in what they were doing, and a small handful of people that really understood and had workable technologies. the interesting thing is that the general complaint has always been the same. No money, have very little time to dedicate to this type of research because I got a family to support and a mortgage and all of the normal trappings of everyday life in this country. But in recent times, I hear a lot of commotion of things going on in this direction. I no longer have the wherewithal to run around and see who's doing what and whether or not there is something substantial, to the various claims. But it's my hope that sometime in the next 2 or 3 years, that we will be witness to some interesting technological advances which will at least demonstrate that there are other alternatives. It doesn't even have to be, the ultimate solution. All it has to do is demonstrate that there's repeatable and explainable reasons for these hyper-efficient energy systems and that they don't really violate any laws of nature. If somebody can do that, in any number of different ways, it's going to make an enormous change in the general consciousness and also in the existing paradigm.
Okay, well, in a sense, it sounds almost like I put the cart before the horse because you have some things that you want to discuss. But I just wanted to get sort of a temperature, if you will, as to what you feel is going to happen or, what you see happening from the various people that you talk to and the people that you work with. And, it's not like everybody keeps their work a secret, at least amongst peers in the same area. Although, again, we hear nothing of an official nature in regard to any improvements to technology. We have this argument going on today about cap and trade, which is just another Ponzi scheme. There's nothing to it other than somebody wants to start making a lot more money by putting ridiculous demands upon the general populace as to what's going to be allowed and what's not going to be allowed, and everything has a price. I mean, you want to talk about communism and slavery all rolled into one. It's being spoken of as if this is some solution to the world's problems, and yet it's just more of the same financial corruption. So we talk about that enough on a nightly basis that we don't have to go into that other than to reference that each new idea that they come out with, after they create a series of lies and then false explanations for what's going on, then they try to manipulate the consciousness of the people into a position where they can just devise another scheme. They call it sustainable energy, when there's nothing sustainable about something that wastes energy or that pollutes the planet. There's nothing sustainable about it. They're interested in sustaining their corrupt machine, their financial carousel, if you want to call it that. So please, if you want. Now, we had been talking a little bit about dielectricity last week, and we got off of that topic. If you want to pick up and go into that a little bit.
Well, the dielectric aspect is a very important one because it's my belief that the total electric phenomenon that we refer to as the electromagnetic wave is not just a transverse wave, but it's a combination of a transverse disturbance and a longitudinal disturbance. And the true propagation geometry is a spiral. And what's interesting about it is if you take a spiral, like let's say a spring, for instance, a large diameter spring, and you hold it in your hand and shine a spotlight through it onto a piece of white paper, depending on the angle of interaction between the spring and the light, you'll produce a sine wave on the, or something very close to sine wave, on the projection to the paper. And the interesting thing about that, of course, is that it's just another way of demonstrating that the electricity that we're using is only part of what's available. And the sinusoidal disturbance that we send down our transmission lines are effectively transverse waves, and most of the forces that are associated with that movement can also be called, you know, transverse in their general arrangement. But the full wave, in order to get the spiral, you have to have more than one type of displacement involved. And the idea that the natural form of electricity in space is actually a spiral which occupies three dimensions, and essentially the disturbance that we have more or less focused on for utilization in power systems is a forcing function which is a sinusoid. It tells you that there's a whole dimension's worth of additional ability to do work which is missing from our technology. And the interesting thing about it is that the missing component is the longitudinal wave, and the longitudinal wave, or the carrier of that longitudinal wave, is in fact the dielectric component in the electromagnetic system. Now, Tesla was very, very aware of this, and the interesting thing is that he played games with distributed capacitance to harness this wave function, and he understood enough about the relationships between coil geometry and wave geometry that he could literally wind and tune his circuits in such a way that he could maximize the transverse component or the longitudinal component, or perhaps both. But in the experiments that he did with wireless transmission of electricity, it seems as if the longitudinal wave components were maximized. And, of course, in his equipment, this was achieved by very careful spacing of the distance between the windings on each turn of his coils, and also the impedance structure with which the coils were terminated. And when all of this is properly done, what happens, of course, is that a dielectric disturbance moves down the axis of the coil by traveling between the turns of wire, just like it does in a normal circuit where it travels between the plates of a capacitor through the dielectric properties of the insulation medium in between. And allows you to tune the circuit in such a way as to maximize this effect in such a way that the energy that becomes dominant in the oscillating circuit is not the transverse component but the longitudinal component. And This, of course, gives completely different reflection characteristics back onto the primary source of the power that's running the whole circuit, and changes the understanding of the term efficiency. Because the transverse wave is traveling in such a way that it doesn't really interact with the various natural components that allow any kind of a gain to be demonstrated in the system. As a matter of fact, it's more associated with losses. But the longitudinal wave, which is akin to a sound wave moving through the air or a liquid like water, for instance, propagates through the ether in a way that allows the response of the ether's elasticity and its other properties to affect the overall wave impedance. And so therefore there are ways in which you can use circuits designed in that way to literally produce effects that are decoupled from the primary power source. And what this results in, of course, is a situation where you have a gain noticed in the system. Now, there are other forces involved in order for this to work, like, for instance, the electric field is the primary component, and various aspects of the magnetic fields in the equipment that you're playing with are all necessary to understand and bring into cooperative formal organization to see these effects. But the point is that if you had one genius that was capable of doing this 100 years ago with relatively simple equipment, and I say relatively simple because actually it's not that it's simple. You know, the geometry and the calculations and the equations are pretty darn complex. But the equipment itself is relatively simple in the sense that it doesn't require giant computers or microwave towers or any of this kind of stuff. It's essentially just coils, capacitance, and knowledge of the relationship between these types of currents and geometry itself. And so in that respect, it's simpler than some of the other things we've achieved. And the whole point of bringing that up is just to say that if one guy did this 100 years ago, paying for most of it out of his own pocket with the money that he earned from selling his patents to Westinghouse, just imagine what an entire engineering group that was given an unlimited amount of funds to work with could accomplish once they start to understand these basic concepts. And that's what I envision. That's what I think the future is going to hold. Once these ideas are in the proper hands, so to speak, I think that you have enough brilliant people who already think outside the box, or at least want to, that with a little bit of guidance and a little bit of financial support, this world could become a different place very quickly.
Mm-hmm. With you describing, like, the coil windings that Tesla used and his understanding of the space in between the windings of that coil, I guess if you continued with the example of a spring, you could say that the longitudinal wave would be moving in the space between the coils of the spring, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it would be kind of similar to the type of displacement that you would get if you squeeze the spring and then relax the spring. And if you could picture that happening in such a way that the spring wasn't moving, but rather the field around the spring was mobile, then you get a pretty good idea of the kind of displacement that he was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this something that he maybe intuited and didn't really need to work out in an equation, or was this discovered as a result of let's say, working out some equations to test if this was mathematically possible?
Well, first of all, I'd like to dispel one really big erroneous line of thinking that somehow seems to have crept into the picture where Nikola Tesla is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
He's got hundreds of patents, as we all know, and many, many wonderful lectures and articles that were written, but very, very little mathematical expression ever accompanies any of that stuff. And so for some reason, people who really and truly have started to believe that he was a high-class tinkerer and not really an engineer, and that he didn't have a good grasp on higher mathematics. Nothing could be further from the truth. You cannot duplicate the work that that man was doing without first understanding the theory and secondly, being able to express those concepts mathematically, because there are just too many damn variables. I worked for 4 whole years just on one equation that represents this kind of activity with the help of Mr. Hamill, my mathematician friend. And the stuff that we came up with, the equations were complicated enough because the forcing functions were so peculiar. But what was really amazingly complicated was the fact that the constants in each section of the equation were essentially represented by matrices, which is another way of saying that it wasn't just one number, but a whole series of potential solutions which depended upon your choice of specific variables that you wanted to use to clarify the general mathematical statement. And you can't build this stuff without going down that path. Now, granted, he may have come up with different equations than we did, because we don't know exactly what he was doing. But I can tell you this much. He would have run into some stuff that was just as complicated, or perhaps more complicated. And considering the level of expertise that he exhibited, there's no way in the world that man didn't have an incredible foundation in higher mathematics. And if you read the book, Prodigal Genius by John O'Neill, it very specifically tells you in there the type of mathematical rigor that Tesla chose to pursue during the course of his education. And a little bit more research on the part of a curious reader will bring you quickly to the realization that what was taught in those days in college for an engineering course was at least 10 to 20 times more rigorous and more complex than what's taught today. And as I said in previous shows, there's a whole lot of very critical information that has a strong bearing directly on these pursuits, which have been deliberately eliminated from most university curriculums. And that can't be a coincidence. You know, some of the stuff you can still study if you choose to do so, but only at the doctorate level. And in mm-hmm. Tesla's day, it was considered fundamental. So,
yeah. Well, I think you understand why I asked that question, basically, just to get a feel for how much of his prowess in terms of being an inventor and his ability to visualize or conceptualize an application. It's almost like I think he probably operated on all levels equally proficiently as he would conceive of something. You invent something the power plant that he did at Niagara Falls, and then you begin to wonder what would happen if you didn't need wires, or if there was another way to find electricity other than through motive force and you know that process of transformation that takes place using water and these huge generators. And the fact that if he knew that dielectricity was really the answer to maybe an unlimited supply of energy or power, if you want to use that term, then it seems that he was always working towards that. Certainly he discovered that. He found that answer.
Well, not only that, I mean, you are correct in that, I'm sure, but that's not the only thing. If you study his life, anything that he noticed, he always took it to the total extreme in his investigations, because he realized intuitively that when you do that, you always wind up stumbling across stuff that you would never understand otherwise. Mm-hmm. The perfect example of that is with his so-called high-frequency work. He started off into the high-frequency realm as a direct consequence of the work that he was doing with rotating magnetic fields at 60 and 50 cycles. And then he starts asking questions like, okay, you know, we know the effects of inductive reactants, we understand the effects of synchronous reactants at these low frequencies. Are there upper limits? What happens when you start to increase the rotational rate to a point where, you know, right now we can't even conceive of it? You know, is it the same old thing, or do other phenomena occur? Mm-hmm. So he would stretch the thing as far as he could do it, or as far as he could take it. And it's a known fact, for instance, that he built his own high-frequency alternators, which went up to the hundreds of thousands of cycles per second. And there are a lot of experiments with that. And that was actually involved with early radio work. As a matter of fact, I can't think of the guy's name right now. I can see his face. But anyway, there was one guy who latched on to Tesla's high-frequency generator work and later used that, essentially pirated the design, scaled it up, and used that for powering the first transatlantic radio station, which ironically came out of New Jersey. It was Alexanderson. The Alexanderson generator was essentially a spinoff of Tesla's high-frequency generating device. And then he did the same thing with the disruptive discharge and with capacitive phenomena. He would take things to their upper limit to understand better what happens when, you know, variables are forced to change, whether they be frequency or amplitude of voltage or, you know, the magnitude of the current, you know, whatever it was you wanted to play with. And it was that type of methodic curiosity that led him to understand the importance of the dielectric wave. Because if you look at his own notes, he tells you quite bluntly that once he understood the displacement current associated with the dielectric and the capacitor, he asked himself the exact same question. He said, what happens if the dielectric becomes more and more refined and the distance between the plates becomes larger and larger and larger? And that's what actually led him to understand that at certain voltages and certain frequencies, as long as the circuit impedance is properly adjusted, you can have one wire transmission of power of AC with perfect efficiency. And it was a leap then from the one-wire understanding to the no-wire understanding, which led to the wireless transmission concept. So So all of these things interact in a very specific way, and his understanding came from not only his grasp of theory, but also the fact that he was a thorough and amazing experimentalist. But he also has a catch.
Go ahead.
For a while.
Mm-hmm. There's another question that I have in terms of this longitudinal wave. It seems to be something that might invite or might reveal some explanation for why we have so many different harmonics that are traveling on a tri-phase electrical system, where noise filters or devices have to be used to eliminate those harmonics. Is that a natural phenomenon, or is that something that's intentionally being added to the wave? In other words, to use the basic 50 hertz cycle, let's say, as a carrier.
Are you referring to a single phase system or a three phase system or what?
Well, let's say on a three-phase system, the average person that's hearing hum or maybe reacting to some unknown or unseen frequencies that are riding these fundamental waves on the current, in other words, that's coming into the house.
The biggest cause of most harmonics is some type of an imbalance in the three-phase system. One way, of course, that you can do that pretty readily is to burden the system, start off with a balanced load and then burden the system with a lot of additional single-phase loads that you're not distributing properly. Another way of doing it is to run a very inexpensive squirrel cage type motor on a three-phase line, and the higher order harmonics, like the third and fifth harmonic, for instance, and maybe some seventh harmonic, this is generated in the course of this type of activity, and it gets into the wiring and it runs all around the system. So just imagine if you have a grid that's supporting, many different industrial customers, and the overall effect is that there are thousands of motors running. You can get some pretty messed up electricity as a result of that. And that's one of the reasons why we now have this new concept where they install these enormous filters at the input terminals to some of these high-tech industries, for instance. They have a lot of computers and stuff, and they essentially sell them what they term as premium power. And premium power is just a sine wave that's been stripped of all of the higher harmonics that might have been riding on that 50 or 60 is not going on from another wave. But the interesting thing is that people don't seem to realize that one of the most amazing aspects of harmonics when it comes to these systems is that not the fact that they're just there and idly racing around in the circuitry, but with a proper understanding of what you're doing, you can cause the appearance of harmonics which are self-ordering. And that becomes the basis of something really exciting, because if you have a fundamental sine wave and you don't have to add any energy to the system, and you get self-organizing harmonics which create a square wave out of that sine wave, by adding all of the higher order harmonics to the to the situation, now you've got negative entropy. You've got a system that's actually growing in complexity and order, and will end up carrying a higher component of energy than it started with. And interestingly enough, you know, everybody squawks about this as being a violation of conservation of energy, what have you. But Ilya Prigogine was given the Nobel Prize for demonstrating that there are many systems in nature which are already self-ordering. And so it's a question of understanding the relationships between what we call systems in equilibrium versus systems in chaos. And there's this really amazing area right in between the two where you kind of oscillate between total chaos and total or totally predictable and controllable situation with a very controlled periodicity. And that can be referred to as complexity. And the complexity theory basically tells you that negative entropy and zero entropy systems are not impossible. They just require another order of magnitude in the complexity of the system and in the number of variables that need to be synchronized and controlled. But as long as the degrees of freedom are kept small, then those other parameters become highly manageable. And that's where people, for some reason, don't seem to go beyond. They stop right there. But Tesla made that journey, and he went right along with it because he followed the directions that were implied by his experiments and by the response that he got from nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, that's one of the beautiful things about an independent experimentalist. You know, if he has the financial wherewithal to support his work, and he's got the right mindset, nature will take him wherever the heck he wants to go, sooner or later. But when you're working for one of these big megalithic companies, and they control all the money, and they tell you what you're going to work on, it's a whole different ballgame. I was just thinking about it the other day, and it's kind of like the difference between a beautiful wild stallion that's running around, you know, in the wilderness or in the plains, doing whatever he was born to do. And that same horse, when he's captured and broken for saddle work, just becomes a completely different critter. You know, you can see a change in the animal. It isn't just that he's docile. Something's taken out of him. And that's why they refer to it as he's broken. And that's exactly the kind of contrast that exists between, you know, a really passionate, independent investigator like Tesla, for instance, and some of these guys who just have been broken in the service of these big companies and are told what to develop and what to think. Now, maybe both types are necessary in the scheme of things, but they're very, very different as to what they accomplish and how they perceive the world.
Mm-hmm. My reason for asking that question regarding this aspect of the harmonics is twofold. Some years ago, when I was operating my recording studio in the vicinity of an industrial site that had a very large motor that ran maybe an hour or two a day, but when it was turned on, usually I was open for business, and there would be a harmonic traveling on the electrical line that was audible, even though I was using certain types of noise filters and surge protectors and what have you, conditioned power, you could say, to keep everything stable. And eventually the company was proven to be the cause of this distortion, so they had to change the hours at which they operated this equipment. I put up enough of a fuss that they had to do that. And I began thinking, well, if this is able to, if this distortion and these harmonics are able to travel on the electrical waves, even though it's not my intention to receive them, certain people within a certain area are going to hear these harmonics and, or imagine, I mean, the thought went through my mind, imagine what it might do to someone's health if they're exposed to this constantly and they're unaware of it. And more recently now, the second part of the reason for making this comment is I've come across a number of stories where people are attributing that phenomenon to ill health. And there are some companies that manufacture filters for the purpose of eliminating those harmonics. And people get almost immediate relief as soon as that phenomenon stops. Now, in both instances, I thought to myself, well, if there's something coming into the building on the basic electrical ingress, isn't it possible to capture that and somehow transform it into a usable frequency?
Absolutely. The only thing there, well, that's an interesting concept. As a matter of fact, I know people that have played around with that, myself included, but only in a limited way, because my understanding of the situation, of course, is that even though the harmonics are there, they're actually being generated by somebody else's expense. But that doesn't mean I can't use them. It just means that they're not really free. Somebody else is paying for them. But the fact of the matter is, you can do that, and you can do it rather easily. All you got to do is know which harmonic you're interested in tapping, and then you can just build a circuit that peaks. Literally a tank circuit that peaks at that particular frequency, and it will pass that frequency, and you can do something with it. So you could theoretically build a whole series of filters that work that way and maximize the effect of each harmonic to the point where you can extract that energy and do something with it. But you have to realize that that's not truly free. It's only free with respect to you, the user.
Because yes,
the
but
guy who's
yeah.
running the motor is actually paying for it.
Well, yes, but I look at it from the standpoint that okay, he's paying for it, but he's sending it to everyone else without even them requesting it. In other words, it's a byproduct. It would be kin to air pollution that could be captured and transformed into something useful, recycled in a sense. But I would think. If it's a high frequency, then or depending on what the frequency is, you could put a low pass filter on that line and then divert it to another area where it could be transformed into something useful instead of being an impediment.
You can definitely do that. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you something that's really interesting. On transmission systems, they're deriving power from hydroelectric stations. And of course, there aren't too many of them anymore, but there's still quite a few of them around. The interesting thing is that in the early stations, before they understood all the various complexities associated with that type of power generation, they had these huge shafts that were attached to the alternators, which were being turned by the turbines in the dams. And the shafts were just basically solid shafts built, because that was the amount of size that they required to carry the armatures or the rotors of these huge generators. But the interesting thing was that torsional characteristics of those shafts were ignored. And once they put them into play and put a load on the alternator, what they found was that the load frequency was like, let's say, 60 cycles. But there was a secondary torsional oscillation, which was coming in at 120 cycles. And that was literally due to the elasticity, the torsional displacement of the shaft, because of the way it was made, without giving consideration to the fact that it was an active member in a secondary oscillation mode. And what would happen would be that they would get these enormous amounts of current movement, which were in phase with the second-order harmonic rather than the fundamental. And sometimes they were so powerful that they actually pulled more power out than the system was designed to handle, and oftentimes either wrecked the transmission facility or they wrecked the generator itself. So they eventually built them with a segmented construction that deliberately squelched torsional oscillations. But the reason that I mention that is because the difference between frequency resonance and energy resonance actually lies in that, in an understanding of that type of phenomenon. The frequency resonance, usually the circuit, the tank circuit, is made resonance to the activity that is represented by the fundamental that you want to focus on. The interesting thing is that in energy resonance, you deliberately pump the system with the parametric relationship between the fundamental wave and the secondary oscillation. So, like, for instance, your forcing function might be 120 cycles, even though the activity that you want to focus on is going to be at 60 cycles. And the difference is, in one situation, the power that's delivered is only moving in one direction. It's like when you push a kid on a swing. The length of the swing and the mass of the child creates a natural period of oscillation for that swing, because it's just like a big pendulum. And when you push on the kid, the energy that you exert during that push is transmitted into the kid and used up by the friction in the ropes and in the bearings or whatever is at the top of the swing. But it never comes back. It never comes back to you. But if you can imagine a system in which the child is still swinging at the same frequency, because the head mass and the length of the swing determine the basic natural period of the system. But the forcing function is such that in the first portion of the movement, energy or work is transferred from the pusher to the child on the swing, and he goes out and comes back. And on the way back, the motion is reversed in such a way that it tends to break the action of the child rather than to add more power to the system. Now, that second half of that cycle represents power flowing in the opposite direction. And the whole key to all of this stuff is in understanding situations involving resonance with double power flow. And for some reason, people have a lot of trouble with that. And it's not investigated. And yet that's really one of the most important things you could ever look into.
Well, that's in essence, what you're describing is also an explanation for the harmonics that entered my building from that industrial site. When they really revved up this motor, it changed, and I would say the initial frequency was around 400 hertz, but it would rise up to 1600 hertz with no problem. It seemed like they would put the motor that they were driving to drive this conveyor belt, which was a pretty large piece of equipment. Both were very very large. At the moment they turned it on and started turning the motor and running the conveyor belt, you would hear the frequencies coming in. And as they turned it on high, that pitch would go up. I would say it was roughly 3 octaves above the electrical current frequency. And when they sped it up, it would go up another 2 octaves at least. And then, of course, there are other harmonics happening there that that are not fundamental tones, you know, fundamental to the harmonic tone that was coming through. I knew it was a harmonic because it was coming in on the electrical line. However, it in and of itself was a pure tone. It had the it sounded like a sine wave. It didn't sound like a sawtooth wave nor a square wave, to use, or a triangle wave. It had the similarities of a sine wave. So in essence, that's the backflow, or, you know, the return of the swing, as you're describing. It's just that it's riding in the original frequency. Had that motor not been on, that phenomenon would not occur.
Right.
Okay. So in essence, it's the same thing. He's paying for it, but really he's sending it. You know, it's not like... My system was pulling it in as much as it was. He was sending it. It was finding a place to travel on the power entering my building.
Right, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. So it, again, I'm sort of repeating myself, but it seems that that could be put to very good use. In fact, there's probably some phenomena occurring at that frequency that you could build all kinds of new technologies on that, if that's something that's always there. I would think to some extent it is, based on the fact that regular people who are not experiencing an industrial inconvenience because of motors and generators that are being run, just the fact that there's all this noise that is frequency that could be captured and tuned to a particular useful purpose.
Well, that's very similar to what Tesla was doing with the experiment in Colorado Springs, because essentially what he was doing was noticing that lightning discharges, which he didn't have to pay for, were being created every time there was an electrical storm. Mm-hmm. And these produced huge surges of various harmonic frequencies in moving through the earth. And his equipment was receiving that. And as he pointed out, it was free as far as he was concerned. But in that particular case, nobody's footing the bill because it's an act of Mother Nature. And that's the whole point. You want to move to a system where the circuitry is activated by an agent that is natural, and you don't have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the idea of a gain comes in. And you can have a gain in a given system if you have another agent that's doing the work on the system outside the realm of what we would term as your personal expenses.
And yeah,
this is where the idea of free energy comes from. It's just that it's a stupid term because it doesn't really describe anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what people really want is free work. And to have work done for free, some agent has to pick up the difference. And if that difference is paid for by a natural function that's somehow supplied by the environment, now you've really got something. And that's what the whole system is really about.
Yeah. And that's why I dwelt on that specific topic, because it's something that's not expected to be there, but it's there, you see. And so if that's there, what are the odds that there's something else that's not even traveling through the wire that we can capture the same way? And
right.
Inexpensively.
That's right. And the interesting thing is, there is such an agent. Well, actually, there's more than one. But the one that Tesla was focusing on in his wireless power transmission experiment is the electric field of the Earth, which is mm-hmm. actually created by the sun. So it's 10 times or a million times better than the solar panels or windmills. Mm-hmm. And it can be used all over the face of the Earth if you understand how to tap into it. And mm-hmm. that's what one of the things Tesla was monkeying around with.
Well, we're out of time. Maybe we can talk about that next week, if you're up to it. That particular aspect of his research. And
I'm up to it, huh?
Are you up to it?
I don't know. I'll let you know next week.
Okay. Well, Jim, we're out of time. Unfortunately, it's a very interesting discussion. I want to wish you safe travels and also a very pleasant Labor Day. Don't work on Labor Day if you can avoid it.
Well, yeah. It's that poisonous word, work. Try to avoid it.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show, and I look for your, forward to your appearance next week on Evident Footprints. So I wish you a good night, Jim.
Thank you, Don. Take care.
All right. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. And tonight's special guest, scientist inventor Jim Murray. Also want to thank Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting the show over at bbsradio.com. Tonight, Don Newsom on the sound. Also would like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Have a great weekend, great holiday. Be safe. Don't do anything stupid. And we'll see you back here next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. A. Truat. In the meantime, thanks for tuning in. I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.